Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. In an eventful few days in Fiji politics, an opposition party has boycotted the official opening of Parliament. The protests come as six predominant Fijians were released from custody without charge after spending a night in a police cell and facing intense police questioning over their role in a meeting last week. The president of Fiji's National Freedom Party, Tupou Dramodolo, says the events prove Fiji's democracy is a farce. Alex Perote reports from Suva.
Fiji's parliamentary term reopened with the usual pomp and ceremony, the military band and naval officers arriving and standing at attention as the Prime Minister and MPs were kept waiting for the arrival of the President, Georgi Konrote. But the President's tardiness was overshadowed by the absence of the NFP MPs, Biman Prasad and Prem Singh. Mr. Prasad had spent the weekend in police custody.
Ending up in a police cell is never a dignified stuff, but we were treated well by the police officers, and we were told that the files have been forwarded to the Director of Public Prosecution's office for a decision on whether would be charged or not.
The possible charges relate to a gathering last week to discuss the constitution to coincide with Fiji's Constitution Day. Police have alleged it was a public meeting, held without a permit, and thus in contravention of the public order decree. The first man to be taken in on Saturday was Athar Singh, the union leader. He wasn't a speaker at the event, but a member of the audience.
Well, the allegation they made against me was that I participated in a meeting which was unlawful because there wasn't a permit obtained. So that's the allegation they made. I've denied the allegation, and I stand by that. In terms of what the law really is, I think there's a debate.
The president of the National Federation Party, Tupou Dranindalo, says the government has never clarified which of its many decrees it enacted after the 2006 coup are still current. She says the democracy that Fiji purports to uphold is a farce. Other detainees like Sitiveni Rambuka and Biman Prasad faced a line of questioning about their comments at the meeting, some of which were deemed to be against national security. Biman Prasad says he has spoken openly in the parliament about his concerns on the constitution, concerns the United Nations has also raised when it encouraged Fiji to review it. He says the constitution isn't strong enough when the military decrees trump the constitution's own Bill of Rights.
I have called for a allocation of funds in the last budget session to get the Law Reform Commission to review some of these decrees to ensure that these decrees are consistent with the provisions in the Constitution.
Mr. Singh says he will lodge a complaint with the International Labour Organization, as he says Fiji agreed at the last review to ensure that the provisions of the Public Order Decree would not be applied to trade unions, and he says this draconian action by the police broke that promise.
Well, I mean, it shouldn't be happening at all. We are surprised it's still happening after 2040 elections. The expectation was that after 2040 elections, now that the government has got, you know, absolute control on governance and parliament, that they would start acting in a more relaxed manner.
Athar Singh says he can't understand why the authorities are so concerned about people getting together to discuss important issues in Fiji. In his speech for the opening of Parliament, the President, Georgi Konrote, told the House that in this second half of the parliamentary term, the government would review several laws, including the Public Order Decree. If the men are charged, they will be ruled out of running for the 2018 election. In Suva, Alex Perrottet.
As many as 10,000 people walked for peace in the Papua New Guinea capital last weekend. The governor of Port Moresby says the Sunday morning event was planned as a stand against violence in the country, following a brawl at a rugby league match which left one innocent bystander dead. Powell's Parkers tells Dominic Godfrey the death of Joe Pydick was a tragedy and that he and others are ashamed of.
We don't condone this type of activity, and we want to make a statement. It is not something that we accept, and we want the public to come out to make that statement loud and clear to ourselves more particularly. Also, it's leading up to our anniversary of our 41st year of independence. We want to also make a statement for peace and unity in our country.
Next year, of course, PNG is co-hosting the Rugby League World Cup. Has there been any reaction to this outbreak of violence from your co-host countries?
Yes, you know, we had a grave concern expressed, especially by the Rugby League World Cup Secretariat down in Australia, and they rightfully expressed to us that our games that we are going to host might be at risk. But we have given them the assurance that it's only a minority activity. This doesn't represent all our people in Papua New Guinea, and especially in Port Moresby. And so I hope they put their fears to rest. And we're looking forward to hosting the three games for the Rugby League World Cup. We will be hosting the Under-20 FIFA Women's World Cup too in November and December of this year. That's 16 countries coming from five continents of the world. Young leaders of tomorrow will be coming to our city and our country, and it's also important that we send that message loud and clear to, you know, the participating countries in particular, but the world generally, that this type of behavior is not acceptable, not tolerated. It's something that we don't condone, and that's why we came out in big numbers on Sunday with our Minister for Sport and the Rugby League board and the chairman and some of our rugby teams and other sporting officials. Everybody came out in a very strong, powerful way, and I hope that message, especially going to our own people. It's a problem that we have with our own people, and we need to get our people to change their behavior, change their habit, and that's essentially the main purpose we marched yesterday. We need our people, majority of whom, they reject violence, and if many more of our people come out and make this type of statement, then it will get this minority to change their behavior and attitude. So I'm very pleased with the outcome yesterday.
What would the message be to the people of Papua New Guinea and Port Moresby?
Violence is an impediment to the prosperity and development of our people.
A year ago, Pacific leaders at their annual Talk Fest agreed to send a fact-finding mission to Papua to investigate allegations of human rights abuse. But Indonesia was against it, so Pacific Islands Forum mission to Papua never happened. At this year's Forum summit in Papui, alleged human rights abuses in Papua still feature in the communique, but there was no commitment to try to do anything specific about it. However, Joe Collins from the Australia West Papua Association told Don Wiseman that this is still better than in most recent years at the Forum.
But I was slightly encouraged that they actually still mentioned West Papua in the communique about the human rights situation. I mean, until last year, I'd been dropped off the TIFF agenda for about 6 years. So the fact that it's still mentioned in the communique is slightly encouraging. But on the other hand, disappointing that they seem to have let Jakarta off the hook in pursuing the TIFF fact-finding mission to West Papua.
There is no commitment to actually do anything, is there?
No, it just seems to be a general where we are concerned about the human rights situation. As you say, no commitment, and the only way they can show real commitment is actually continue to ask Jakarta for a TIFF fact-finding mission. And that would be a definite commitment to go there and actually listen to the West Papuan people, what they are actually asking for. Because it's pointless to hear our governments continue to say Indonesia is now a democracy. Well, West Papuans are still marching in the streets 53 years after Indonesia took over, risking torture, arrest. If everything was so good, why were they still marching in the streets 53 years after the takeover?
It seems remarkable, really, that given that there is so much support from a large number now of the island countries on the West Papua issue, that the Forum as a body can relegate the issue in this way. I know John Key and others talked about Indonesia not liking the word fact-finding. Well, does that matter?
Oh, I mean, I think we'd have to say that it was probably due to Australia and New Zealand that the whole issue was given just concern about human rights and that the TIFF fact-finding mission was dropped from the agenda. Certainly Australia will support Indonesia. You know, as we all know, Indonesian sovereignty over West Papua. And I'm not sure why they seem to be totally afraid of actually raising the issue of West Papua at the Pacific Island Forum in any commitment to the West Papuan people. And there's no doubt there's a huge groundswell of support from the people, civil society organisations, church groups in support of West Papua. And for all the talk about being inclusive and listening to the people, the fact that it's not really on the agenda that much would indicate that the leaders are not really listening to the people. But I presume it will get better. As I say, slightly encouraging it was in the communique. I was a bit worried that the whole issue might have been dropped again for another 5 or 6 years, but that in itself was slightly encouraging. The MSG is coming up in October in Port Vila, and hopefully there the ULMWT may actually get full membership. But again, we also have the new coalition on West Papua with governments Vanuatu, the Solomon Islands, Tuvalu indicating support, the ULMWP, PNGO, the Pacific Island Association of Non-Government Organisations. So the whole issue has not gone away. It's getting bigger and bigger. It's greatly encouraged that groundswell of support in the Pacific. And I think if it continues, surely it would, the leaders will begin to realise that it is time to start raising issues seriously at the UN. Vanuatu and the Solomons have raised it at UN committees before. But I think the groundswell of support may begin to really have an effect and try and get it re-subscribed on the UN Decolonisation Committee. I mean, that might seem a hard ask, but it's possible. It is possible. I think self-determination is back on the agenda in the Pacific. You have the referendum in Kanaki, New Caledonia, Bougainville, British Polynesia is back on the Decolonisation Committee. I mean, I think the self-determination in the Pacific area is back on the agenda as an issue.
An NGO leader in the Pacific cannot understand why the region is hurling to complete a trade deal. Pacific leaders at last week's forum summit committed the finalization negotiations of Pacer Plus agreement by the end of next month. This comes despite 67 civil society groups issuing an open letter asking them to slow down the process and undertake proper impact assessments. Hugh Govan, who is part of the locally managed Marine Area Network and works around the region, told Don Wiseman there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the way leaders' meetings across the Pacific are now being conducted.
In the context of this leaders' meeting, there's a lot of disappointment in general with the way the leaders' meetings are going these days. We are under a new approach to regionalism. The Pacific Plan is history, and now there's supposedly the framework for Pacific regionalism, which was meant to be more inclusive, have good governance, human rights, etc. in there. They've opened avenues for civil society to interact with the leaders. And last year, West Papua was put on the agenda, and it's on again this year. So there's some satisfaction with that. However, the issues of West Papua and also the new membership of France is not something that's been debated in countries or with civil society, but it's happened in this last leaders' meeting, seeming to forget the reason why they weren't there in the first place. And also, you know, problem with West Papua, the human rights issues there, which I think most people would agree is a serious concern and should be dealt with, but somehow the leaders have not been able to move that agenda at all forward. So in that context, it would probably be naive to expect a major turnaround in the leaders' decision on the Pacer Plus trade deal at this meeting. But the concerns remain, and I think the population, the people at large, should be concerned that no proper impact assessments have been done. The leaders are making a decision without any facts before them. It's very hard to believe that a good deal has been struck if we don't know what the potential negatives and positives or good and bad sides of this deal are.
In the communique from the Pacific Islands Forum Summit, they do say that there were some assessments organised by the Office of the Chief Trade Advisor.
Yes, indeed. We demanded strongly for nearly 2 years, well, longer than that, some of us, but two major letters have gone to the leaders and the trade ministers requiring independent and comprehensive impact assessments across all sectors of poverty, food security, natural resources, and so on. We stated this very strongly in an opportunity for consultation at Christmas, and the trade advisor reacted by commissioning a small and hardly independent, as it was underneath his office, impact assessment. Unfortunately, that impact assessment's credibility is slightly a concern, as well as it was already, that they'd already been advising leaders they should conclude with the existing text. In other words, it's not a surprise that the impact assessment, such as it is, seems to be more validating the position of the trade advisor rather than opening up any new discussions. Having said that, if you look at the people that were consulted and involved with that, it doesn't involve most of civil society organizations that are concerned, the major ones. And so again, it'd be hard to take it very seriously. I would like to add that civil society, or one NGO in particular, has commissioned their own impact assessments, and those have been endorsed by 50 plus NGOs and lots of individuals. And that impact assessment hasn't even, as far as I'm aware, been considered by any of the trade officials or the leaders.
They know about it, though.
Yes, it was presented to them in the Christchurch meeting.
So it would certainly seem that the way things are going, the trade deal will be finalised before the end of the year. Fiji's not going to be there and PNG is not going to be there either, but there will be a deal put in place, driven along by Australia and New Zealand. So what will civil society do then?
We are heartened by the fact that Vanuatu has also expressed some concerns, and we're hoping that other ministries in other countries will begin to look at this more seriously and expect a reasonable discussion, at least in the national governments and maybe with parliaments. That sort of discussion would, and indeed consultations with civil society, would always be better informed with independent impact assessments. In other words, there's not very much that you could discuss about a trade deal in terms of its bare and naked text. So hopefully these countries will say, well, surely we can look at the implications of this in normal language and assess it across our sectors. The reason for signing this year is very obscure. We cannot see why the rush. Why not get a better deal by getting better information, or at least being sure that you're getting the best deal you could based on this independent information? I'm not sure who benefits from rushing this through.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister says consultations around planned constitutional and political reforms are on track. Joan Namin's Vanuaka Baktak, the longest established party, last week had its annual congress on Santo. He spoke to Johnny Blades about the efforts by the party and the coalition government and its part of to usher in reform and bring younger generations of blood on board.
We have started the constitutional reform. Particularly, we had the amendments to the constitution. The parliament set up the parliamentary ad hoc committee to look into the amendments to the constitution. Has been, I think, they've just completed their work now, and they'll probably be travelling throughout the whole country to make further consultation with the people on those constitutional amendments.
Do outside influences still play a part in politics? Because there have been characters around some of the Vanuatu parties over the years who have maybe funded or supported certain parties which may be linked to some of the instability.
That is always a problem. Political parties here, because of the financial base too weak, they tend to receive donations from elsewhere. And it's very easy for, you know, those kind of influence to penetrate into the political system. Of course, this is why one of the issues we'll be looking at in having an appeal or law which will ensure that every political party are registered, that any donations out there received has to be disclosed. Those are issues that we will be looking at. We're trying to strengthen our political parties.
The Vanuaku Party, you've just had your annual congress. Is the Vanuaku Party still representing the same values these days?
I think so. I think basically this congress that we had was to really try to come up with a roadmap to strengthen the party and grow the party into the future, to make sure that more young people are in. And we were very happy that there were more younger generation attending this congress than ever before. So basically the main theme of this congress is to ensure that the Vanuatu Party comes back again much stronger in the political landscape here. The theme was to the Vanuatu Party come back. We had over 300 delegates attending.
And issues like land and political independence, are they also very important for the younger generations?
Yes, I think that's very important. Because partly it's this communication gap between the older generation and the younger generation. The younger generation doesn't have any sense of history about the struggle, about why we should be, you know, retaining our land. Some tend to sell off their land or lease for long term, and these are issues that we discuss and try to bring the younger generation up to date with the policies of the party and the importance of land and independence, and of course the rights of other people around the world and particularly in the Pacific.
A new study in Papua New Guinea is looking at the viability of offering insurance to people in settlements and villages. PNG has one of the lowest insurance penetration rates globally, according to the 2015 Oxford Business Group study. The study estimates coverage at under 2% of GDP, which is significantly lower than the rest of the region. Capital Insurance is carrying out the study, which is partially funded by a $70,000 grant from the Pacific Financial Inclusion Program. Regional Inclusion Insurance Specialist Michael Carr spoke to Karori Hawkins about its aims and objectives.
Well, basically, this study is regarding some research carried out in specific markets of Papua New Guinea. And it's really looking at two types of property insurance products that Capital Insurance want to investigate. Now, the study really involves, firstly, looking at the housing of the low-income segment to see if it's insurable, to understand what people's attitudes to insurance is, and really to get out there into the settlements and the villages to get a much better understanding of the types of property that's there, its condition, its value, and really to see what it sort of risks it presents from an insurance perspective. The other part of the study involves communal assets, communal property assets. So here we're talking about churches, medical clinics, schools, water pumps and infrastructure like that. Property that the community relies on, and if it was damaged or lost, it obviously would be impacted by that negatively. And in each case, if there is a loss from fire or flood or storm, in each case it's going to affect them financially, either personally because it's their own property, or from a need to contribute to rebuild that damaged or lost property. So it's very important because these people, their property is currently uninsured and they are exposed to these types of risks. So it's important from that point of view.
What are the constraints to insurance in PNG? Why is it that penetration is so low in terms of insurance in PNG?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, there's some reasons that are not particularly relevant to PNG. They're typical to a number of markets in the region. So one of them will be low levels of financial literacy. You know, people have not really understand all of the financial products and services that are available there, that are offered, and how they can help them. And I think also the low quality of construction of some of the properties. This is either commercial property or domestic property. Some of the property is not up to the needed standards for insurers to actually take on board and take ownership of from a claims point of view. So they wouldn't really want to insure these properties because they don't meet the standards. But there are some things that particularly apply to PNG, perhaps more so than other countries. We all know about the type of terrain there, the mountainous terrain and the limited road networks and infrastructure. So that's a barrier to selling insurance. We can talk about the diversity and the culture in PNG. It's a massive country, hundreds of languages, different cultures and customs. So it's difficult to have a uniform approach to that.
And given this, what seems to my limited knowledge, like quite formidable hurdles to overcome, do you think there's a likelihood that the survey will come with a negative result, i.e. it is not financially viable to extend insurance to people in settlements and villages around PNG?
Well, the quick answer is I don't know. Nobody knows until we've actually completed the research and looked at the findings and see what insights we get from that. I mean, irrespective of the actual outcome on insurability or otherwise, the research will be valuable because it'll give us an insight into a part of the market that we don't know anything about now. I mean, the normal conventional insurance companies haven't attracted this market or haven't really attempted to do so. They can't see it as a viable business model. The researchers are actually going out into the settlements, talking to people, going into the villages, talking to people about the insurance. They're looking at the properties, they're assessing the properties, and they're teasing out all the actual issues that an insurance company would be faced with if it's going to offer this cover. So I don't know what the outcome's going to be. That might be one outcome. The insurance company may simply see that it's not commercially possible and viable to make a profit on this type of business, so it's not going to launch the products, or it may launch one of the products. Conversely, it may see a way of actually supplying insurance and create a business model and methods of enrolling customers, paying out claims, etc., to make it justified. So it's a very interesting project from that point of view. And as I say, we're expecting the results out to be out in late September, and that will give us a guide as to where we go from here.
And finally, a Tongan advocate for women and children, Olaf Gutin Bale Linkeli says core beliefs need to change if there's any drop in the region's high rate of violence against women and girls. She told women affairs ministers gathered at the Commonwealth Summit in Samoa that anti-violence campaigns and technical solutions have little impact. But she told Sally Round the focus should be on changing mindsets and behaviours.
Nothing much has progressed in the area of ending violence or forms of violence against women and girls. And when we look at the Pacific, we have some of the highest numbers in terms of intimate partner violence. And so it's not getting any better. Our figures are actually increasing. And so one of my objectives being here is just moving away. You know, we've got into this whole silly business of naming violence against women in terms of violence against women, gender-based violence, domestic violence, and categorizing the types of violence and giving more importance to one over the other. That's what's happened over the last 10 years. And we have to move away from that. Unfortunately and sadly, we're seeing from countries that it's now becoming an issue of violence against women and men, violence against girls and boys. We're not making any improvements in the area of women and girls because we've been basically confused over the last decade. We haven't been putting the woman's experience as the centre of our work.
Do you think you've managed to reset that in any way in the presentation that you have given? Or?
Yeah, well, you know, that, as a civil society representative here, I've tried my best through my presentation. But again, it's up to the ministers whether they take it or not. But, you know, if we're serious about the 2030 agenda, we have to start doing things differently. We have to think outside of the box. We have to go back to where we started, where we placed the woman, the survivor, in the centre of our focus. Her experience would tell us what are the challenges, what are the gaps, what are the violations, and what the solutions should be. Sometimes at these meetings, things can be ideas and solutions that are technical in nature, where these are adaptive challenges. It's challenges that we have to change attitudes, mindsets, behaviours, and technical solutions can't change that overnight or can't change it in a framework of 5 to 10 years. So we really have to look at what are the core fundamental issues that we have to address and have consensus on, that we have to all move together as a Commonwealth to address. And so one of the other things that I raised in my presentation was we need to move away from all these campaigns. There's way too much investment in these campaigns to end violence against women. The White Ribbon campaign, the He for She campaign, the Orange campaign. There's millions of dollars being poured into those campaigns when it should be poured into more substantive work. For example, the judicial bench book that we've just seen that's being launched for East Africa. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do that across the Pacific? Or curricular reform from the education system, class 1 to class 6. We need to start teaching our young boys and our young girls in the classroom that they are equal to each other. Because at the end of the day, in the Pacific, when that little boy and then when that little girl goes home, they're walking into a house where the father believes he's superior to the mother. And so the school needs to provide that education to challenge that and to get the child thinking at a very early age that they're equal to each other.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Until next time, I'm Keith Pelham, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.